Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
Okay.
We're going to try to pack in as much science as we can quickly. And that means three studies on primates at the top here in 3 minutes.
Let's go.
Most of you out there listening will have hopefully heard our long interview with a guy named Edwin van Leeuwen about his research in Zambia. We went over to the Netherlands to talk to him about chimpanzees. Trying to learn from a human how to use a chimpanzee vending machine and then teach others.
Complex tasks. Can they do it?
Yeah. And the whole purpose of talking about those kinds of things is to figure out what differentiates us from our closest relatives, what makes us human. At the end of the day, you can watch that video on YouTube, How to Figure Out Humanity by Teaching Chimpanzees to Use Vending Machines. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go from Zambia, that's where that research was, over to Namibia. Mm-hmm. That's where researchers took a look at baboons and did a very common experiment known as the mirror experiment. Does this animal recognize itself in the mirror?
Yeah.
Like we humans do. And like
a baboon looks at the mirror, does it recognize that's me?
In the mirror.
Okay.
Right. A lot of animals can do this. Can baboons? No.
Can't do it.
Can't do it. The way you do
this. How do you determine that?
Yeah. You put something on their body that they would recognize as not supposed to be there. So what they did is first they shone a laser. They use lasers on baboons, like on their foot or on their hand. So the baboons looks at
they, and then they get out of that. Out of that laser.
I would do the same thing. Yeah. I'd try to scratch it off. What is that? Right?
Yeah.
Now they put them in front of a mirror and have a laser shining on a part of their body that they can't see.
So they're looking at the mirror image with this laser on their head. Do they then scratch their own head?
No. Because they don't recognize that as being them. They think it's a stranger.
Huh.
And so they don't begin scratching their head to try to get the laser off. Therefore, establishing baboons do not recognize themselves in the mirrors. They have failed the mirror test.
All right, next.
Next. Over to Uganda.
Uganda.
Chimpanzees, bonobos, we're going to stick to those primates. They recognize hand signals from each other. So they might sound like they're making a lot of grunts, but there are upwards of 80 signals that they can give with their hands or with their bodies that indicate things. And amazingly, we humans can recognize quite a few of them.
Sign language.
Sign language, yeah. So I'm going to stroke my inner bicep here, Gabe,
okay,
just like that.
Sure.
Just like a chimpanzee, stroking my inner bicep.
Yeah.
What that means is, Gabe, can you groom me? And the other chimpanzee would recognize that. You would go over and maybe start grooming, pulling things out of my hair, sticks, twigs, leaves,
lice.
Insects,
lice.
Okay. Bonobos. Gabe, if you were eating something right now and I put my hand over your mouth, that means give me some of that stuff too. So I'm going to do that to you today at lunch.
Yeah.
If I want some of your food, I'm going to put my hand over your chewing mouth. And both bonobos and chimpanzees, if they shake something really hard, you know what that means? Let's have sex. Probably. It usually means let's have sex if they shake something. So what's new is that researchers in Uganda saw a mother and daughter establish a new signal that is idiosyncratic. It's unique to them and only them. No other chimpanzee does this. And the daughter, her name is Lindsay, puts her hand over the eye of her mom, Beryl. And she started doing this at the age of 3.5. That means, mom, I want to piggyback you.
Okay.
And it took, at the age of 3.5, mom didn't recognize that. By 4.5, she knows. Anytime Lindsay puts her hand over my eye, she wants a piggyback ride.
So they are constantly learning new words, new ways to communicate.
It's like how we humans invent
a new handshake,
you know? Clip, right. Clap, clip, backwards, slap the back, all that kind of stuff. Last
Next.
One. We all know that yawning is contagious.
Yeah.
The question is urination, peeing, is that contagious? These were researchers in Japan. They had about 20 chimpanzees.
Right when you said that, I realized that I have to go.
They had 20 chimpanzees in a sanctuary in Japan, and they looked at 600 hours of tape to confirm something that they thought they were seeing, that in certain circumstances, urination seemed contagious. So what they figured out is that's true, and it depends on two things. Proximity, how close am I to the urinator? And the further away I get, the less likely it is that I'm going to also contagiously urinate,
mm-hmm.
start urinating. And the other thing was social hierarchy does play a role. So if you're strong in the group, Gabe, and you begin relieving yourself.
My role model is peeing. Why don't I do it too?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
sure.
So I think this is interesting because most of the people listening right now are probably familiar with social settings like being at a bar or at a party where someone gets up, usually a bar. It'd be like a bar restaurant. They get up to go use the restroom and then, oh, I'll go with you.
So it's not just to accompany that person. It's because all of a sudden that person realizes that they have to go too. Just like what happened to me just now when you mentioned this.
Or it's social hierarchy. Maybe when the more powerful, more dominant part of this group says, I have to go, you know, break the seal. I'm more likely to go if I'm lower on the rung. In the wild, there are good reasons for doing this. You can be less, if you have predators, it's less likely that they can find you. If you all pee in the same spot, anyone who's ever gone on a road trip knows that before you leave, it's a good idea for everyone to go. There are certain situations, and we humans seem to have moved more away from this. Most guys, for example, don't like peeing next to each other in urinals.
No, depends.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it still happens with chimpanzees. It probably still, to some extent, happens with us humans, and just be aware of that.
A bit more serious now, Connor. We're going to play a clip now from something that happened this Wednesday, January 29th, in Washington.
And I believe that that vaccines play a critical role in healthcare. All of my kids are vaccinated. I've written many books on vaccines. My first book in 2014, the first line of it is, I am not anti-vaccine. And the last line is, I am not anti-vaccine.
That's the voice of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. facing Congress at his nomination hearings. And just for some context there, he wrote a book published in 21, the measles book, where he said, quote, parents have been misled into believing that measles is a deadly disease and that measles vaccines are necessary, safe, and effective. So
he wrote a book saying well-established vaccine against measles.
Parents have been misled to believe that the vaccine is necessary, safe, and effective.
Okay, so
that's on paper.
He incorrectly or falsely cast doubt on a vaccine that has proven itself to work.
Yeah. There's been a lot of discussion and reactions online to the hearings, to the nomination hearings. And one of the things that people are asking, what is wrong with the man's voice when he speaks? That is an affliction he's been dealing with for decades. It is called spasmodic dysphonia. It is a neurological disorder where the muscles that control the opening and closing of the vocal cords involuntarily spasm.
Ah.
Yeah. It's an awful affliction. Up to 13 people per 100,000 around the world. So up to a million people around the world deal with this. And the only way to fix it is with a Botox injection. We reached out to a clinic here in Germany, the Voice Medical Clinic in Hamburg. And this is a woman describing what it's been like living with this affliction.
Also, es ist so, dass ich seit vielen Jahren, mittlerweile sind es 20 Jahre, die gepresste.
This woman is speaking German here, talking about for 20 years how she doesn't like going out in public.
There.
Speaking.
That was the first thought. I never thought about this before. The first thought I had when you talked about it being involuntary is that this would have to be in the category of stuttering or Tourette syndrome, where the physiological ailment that's happening without your control becomes a psychosocial burden. You would want to avoid any situation where this might be noted or noticed or where you would have to feel embarrassed about it. I think the truly horrible part about it is that second one.
This is her doctor, Marcus Hess, who is an otorhinolaryngologist up in Hamburg, describing pretty much the only thing you can do about it.
Die Wirkung vom Botulinumtoxin wird erst nach 2 oder 3 Tagen einsetzen. Dann kommt sie durch eine Phase, wo sie eine gute Stimmgebung.
So he's describing here, when you get this Botox injection, after a couple of days, it starts to work, and it lasts for between 3 and 4 months, when you then have to repeat, get the next injection to deal with it. And what happens was those muscles that are spasming, they're weakened or they're relieved by the Botox.
Sure.
And then it goes away for a little bit and then comes back.
Yeah, my question would be whether health insurance companies would cover that procedure every 3 to 4 months, because if not, that would get expensive quickly and would limit who has access to it. On this show, we obviously plan to address some of the misinformation, for example, about vaccines coming out of the United States and, for example, some of the federal budget freezing that's occurring there, the grants and loans that are no longer happening or that have been put on pause, because these are things, either the information or the lack of science that's happening as a result, the lack of public health initiatives that used to be happening around the world. We will talk about that on this show. That was just, I believe, when you searched for his name, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., that was the most common question on the internet.
A lot of people wanted to know what's wrong with his voice, and that is what's wrong with his voice. It's called spasmodic dysphonia. It's a really unfortunate, and RFK had a resounding voice. He made a lot of money being a public speaker before he got it. And he's himself said, I feel bad for people who have to listen to me. So, yeah, it's tough.
That's it for now, because we have what I think is a deeply interesting interview coming right up on maybe, I almost don't want to say this because it sounds so grandiose and appalling, but maybe the biggest question of our time. I think it's safe to say that. I'll leave you hanging for now. If you have anything to say, though, on RFK Jr. or U.S. policy or anything,
or any of those primates that we were speaking about there.
Yeah. Do you recognize yourself in a mirror? Some of you might not. Let us know, su@dw.com. Gabe, real quick, do you know your carbon footprint?
I don't. I calculated it once, but about 5 years ago.
You went to one of the...
I used a calculator, a carbon footprint calculator, and...
How did it make you feel?
Awful. Terrible.
Yeah.
It was a tough part of my life, because there were decisions that I knew I had to make back then, and they were hard decisions to make.
You were also working on an environmental podcast back at that time.
Yeah.
On the Green Fence.
I remember wondering whether I should ever fly back home to my family to visit them, whether that was okay.
Yeah.
It's a hard decision to confront.
It really is, and we're going to hear from an expert on why we've been made to feel that way and why it's important to know where that narrative is coming from.
Science Unscripted.
Hello, my name is Tom van Laar. I'm an associate professor of narratology, and I've published a paper where we discover the net zero hero.
Well, first of all, Tom, what is the field of narratology?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. we're a small but courageous little discipline. Narratology is the research of how stories, narratives, fiction, changes behavior.
And what have you found out about the narratology of the net zero hero?
Well, what we found out is that in the energy market, energy companies, organizations, governmental organizations, but also mining companies, energy retailers, they are creating this myth of a heroic energy consumer who is going to get us all to net zero.
And how did you discover that? Or how did they create that myth? What is the evidence for that?
So what we did is we collected all the public documents from more than 40 institutions that work in the energy market. So as I said, you know, anything from a government to a mining company and everything in between. And we collected all their documents between 2015 and a couple of years ago. And we then read those documents as if they were Shakespeare. We analyzed them as if they are novels, which they are not. They're actually really boring reports. But we try to read it from a different perspective.
And what did you find out from all that literature? What are they trying to do when it comes to climate narratives?
Well, so, you know, when you read something from a narratological perspective, you basically start looking for the things that we all know from movies and books and, you know, soap operas, video games, etc. You look for characters. You look for plot, you look for drama, all those kind of things. So you're reading, you know, policy documents and annual reports and media releases, but you don't read them for the kind of jargon policy talk. You read them and you try to find these characters and the plot and the drama and all the things you would normally expect in a movie or a book. And that's what we did. We found that they are creating a character, which we have called the Net Zero Hero. And it's this heroic character that is a consumer of energy who is doing all the right things, and they're trying to push that character onto actual consumers to try to convince these consumers to do the right thing.
Isn't this very contradictory? As an energy company, I would never want to create a character who's a net zero hero unless my core product was renewables. Or right? I mean, if I'm an energy company, like you mentioned mining as one of the energy companies, if I'm mining coal, I wouldn't want a net zero hero, would I? Because then it means they stop consuming my coal.
Yeah. And that's why they create the hero in such a way that the hero can only fail. So it's not a successful hero. The hero they create, so I probably should go back a little bit. When we talk about heroes in narratives, in stories, in fiction, heroes usually don't travel alone. You know, think of the big sagas that you know, anything from Lord of the Rings to Harry Potter, any of those really big stories. The hero usually has got some companions that help them out. And the hero usually has some sort of supernatural powers of some level, you know, some sort of magic that they can do. And that's what we know and expect, because that makes the hero successful at the end of the day. What the energy companies promote is a hero without help. So it's kind of a tragic hero. It's a hero who can only fail.
Are these, or is this hero being created... It sounds like, if I understood you correctly, within internal corporate documentation, or is this being pushed outward publicly in order to generate the idea of a net zero hero in the public imagination so that we could all emulate or try to become that when in fact it's impossible?
It's in between. So this is a little bit complicated, but it's not internal documentation. We didn't have access to internal documents. We had access only to public documents. So... like I said, annual reports, media releases, research reports, etc. However, those are all documents that usually only the other entities, the other organizations in this market read those. Right? They talk to each other. What we haven't seen yet, we wouldn't be surprised if that is still coming, is actual, you know, commercial campaigns, right? Advertising type of campaigns. We haven't seen those yet because I think it might have been a little too early. So we've had access to public documentation that is only kind of seen by other companies in that space. I mean, anybody can find them. You know, I could show you where to find them. It's not super hard. It's just that, you know, on our regular day, most of us are not going to be like, hey, let's read the annual report of an interesting mining company. Like, you know, it's just not something we do.
Based on your analysis, Tom, why are energy companies doing this?
Well, you know, it's partly speculation. We don't have an answer from those companies, but they're taking a leaf out of a well-thumbed book. This is a strategy. It's called responsibilization, with a long word. That has been around since, you know, big tobacco was accused of, well, making things that kill people. So big tobacco has been doing this and saying, well, it's up to you. You can choose to smoke the menthols if you feel better that way. Then later we saw the same thing happen with Coke and other big plastic producers or plastic users. Saying, well, you know, consumers, you should recycle. The whole plastic issue is not our fault. And then, you know, now you see the energy companies doing the same thing. You know, British Petroleum, BP, invented a carbon footprint calculator for every user of, carbon, but not themselves.
I'll stick to the Coca-Cola bottle example, because Gabe just bought one. It's sitting on the desk right in front of us. Yeah, that's the sound of him drinking it. And to take this responsibilization to the logical end, if I understand it correctly, we all know a lot of these bottles, Gabe, you're going to recycle yours. A lot of these bottles end up in waterways. They end up in oceans. They become part of this gigantic Pacific Ocean garbage patch. And Gabe can't solve that problem by recycling on his own. And yet by making everyone believe it's their own personal responsibility, we are what, less likely, all of us, to then require of our legislators that they create laws to force companies to change their behavior? Is that why these kinds of campaigns are done?
That is absolutely correct. And on top of that, even if it would, you know, solve the entire issue, if everybody was recycling everything, people don't feel able to do that on their own. You need to give somebody a hand. So whether it is about energy use or plastic use, the companies, they create this idea to basically say, well, you just focus on yourself and what you as an individual can do. It's quite a popular thing, like, you know, everybody's got to pitch in. Yeah, but everybody also means that the big producers of the problems need to pitch in.
I'm struggling to figure out what our listeners or even myself should do with this information, because a net zero hero, I have to be honest, I kind of aspired or aspire still to be that. We, for a long time, avoided purchasing a car. When we did, we got an electric car. We biked everywhere. I have felt bad in the past for buying wine from the country that I believe you're doing most of your work in, Australia, instead of buying local wine. And so,
or flying home to the States.
Yeah, and all the, there's all this guilt attached to it, but is it productive guilt? Because it lowers my footprint. I'm doing the best I can, preserving this place to the extent I can for future generations. You're not saying to abandon that, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not. No, what I'm saying is that we try and we feel bad, because all we're being told is that, you know, you're not doing enough and things are still getting worse and it's just going to get worse from now on. And what that does to a lot of people, it creates this, I'm going to put my head in the sand. I feel overwhelmed. I have climate anxiety. I cannot cope. And that's a very logical, very normal reaction for humans to respond to a tragedy. Because the way the story of climate change is being told is tragic. It's like, well, if we don't do anything, it's all going to get terrible. But it's not necessary to tell the story in that way. There is an alternative way of telling the story. What we know about storytelling is that one of the things that makes stories super, super effective is that things first get bad and then they get better. So they go down and then they go up again. And that is possible. We can tell the story of climate change in a different way. We can say, yes, if we don't do anything, absolutely, things are going to get bad. But if we do actually get through that tough patch, then at the other end, things can be better than they are now.
I'm wondering, Tom, as a master of storytelling that you seem to be, how to deal with this next patch that's coming up following the inauguration of the U.S. president. One of the first things he did was exit the Paris Climate Accords. That is very foreboding for climate policy. How, for people out there who are struggling with that, how do they keep going with the assurance that bad story is gonna, that it's gonna turn out good? What?
Yeah, I understand the anxiety. What you can do is zoom out. So history tends to move in cycles. It tends to move in shapes. And I'm talking about human history here. The way we see how history moves is that usually humans experience their darkest times right before things get really a lot better. And that's because we have this understanding somewhere in our human condition that we have to get through some really dark times to get to a better place afterwards. So if you look in history and you look at other moments where it was really, really dark, you'll also find that not much later, things got a lot better. I mean, you can refer to many different moments, and we all have our own examples in mind, and each of us will have our personal preferences, but you will find the same cycles occurring over and over again. So we're just currently on a downward slope right before it will, you know, move back up.
I guess, do I have to do anything about that? That's what this is anecdotally. I've seen it posted online. You know what? The Paris Climate Accord's falling apart. Some real cynicism. Why should I do all of these little things to try to improve the health of the planet, make all these personal sacrifices, when the monstrosity of the human narrative as it is right now, when it's going to happen anyway, right? So why shouldn't I take some little, you know, cheap little flights all over the place and just live my life and do whatever I want, really, right?
Mm-hmm. Look, there's a few reasons. One is, you know, at some point you're going to regret it because it's not always going to stay this way. And then it will be like, well, what were you doing when? And then fill in the rest of that sentence, right? So usually then in the future want to be able to say, well, I did the right thing when it mattered. Not all of us will do that. But, you know, some of us will do the right thing and we'll be able to say, well, I actually kept on doing the right thing. And, you know, that makes you that makes your future you a lot happier because it will be much easier to tell that story then. The other thing is realize that the reason we often feel like we can't do anything right is because the systems are currently making us feel responsible for something we're not responsible for. The way the story is currently being told is being told like that on purpose. So try to ignore the way the story is being told and focus on the way the story can be told.
That was Tom van Laar speaking to us from Maastricht. He's with the University of Sydney, but at the moment he's touring Europe. Touring universities throughout Europe.
As part of his sabbatical, yeah. Mm-hmm. And really enjoying himself on that trip and helping at least me, I think possibly all of you as well, to give that perspective on humanity that's really zoomed far out in the best way. Right after we stopped the conversation, we were still talking to him because we couldn't stop. And he's like, you know, if you look, every 80 to 100 years in human history, there's a crisis. Mm. And you have to get through it. And then you get through it. And on the back end of it, that was my favorite part of his last answer. On the back end of it, you have a story that you're going to tell the people around you and the family members of the future and yourself. And what is that story? Is it, I was part of the good team working for the good thing? Or is it that I was part of the bad team doing the bad stuff?
Did you remain on the right side of history all throughout the crisis? Or did you just jump sides when it made sense for you?
That's where narrow.
When it was easier to did you take the easy way out?
Yeah,
really. Is the question.
And that narrative, the narratology, has it? It must. I've never thought about this, but have a huge impact on how your family members or your future generations understand themselves and the whole family structure and everyone around them is based on. When things got difficult, our family members do the right thing or the vile thing?
What's your guys' answer?
Let us know, please. DW.com is a website. And we are.
SU@DW.com is the email address to send your post to us.
Yeah, that's how it works.
DW, made for minds.